With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The German reporter came to Tokyo with commissions from respectable newspapers to report on developments happening before the war. This was the 1930s, and everybody knew that World War II was going to rock the globe. But that didn't stop him from leaping into a debauched lifestyle. He drank on an industrial scale and kept dozens of girlfriends. His exploits soon became legendary among Japan's expatriates. The reporter lived with Hanako Miyake, a waitress from his favorite haunt, Das Rheingold. Here, German businessmen and Germanophile Japanese gathered together to drink beer and to perform the Schuttplattler dance to a brass band. He was a nightly fixture at Das Rheingold, where he belted his favorite songs and never left sober. He always departed on his motorcycle and drove through the streets at top speed. Miraculously, he didn't crash. But on May 13th, 1938, he missed a turn and drove his motorcycle directly into a thick wall of the American embassy. Hours later, he awoke in St. Luke's Hospital. His front teeth were missing and his face bloodied. In a state of semi-delirium, he summoned a friend named Clausen. The injured reporter baffled nurses when he slipped his friend envelopes and a conspicuous roll of dollar bills. The reporter then passed out. Richard Sorge was a hard-drinking journalist and Nazi party member, widely respected by the German embassy for his intuition of Japanese politics. He consumed alcohol partly as a means of coping with the stresses of his career in the run-up to World War II. But there was a greater reason for his need of diversion. Sorge was actually Russia's most important spy and an officer in the Soviet Foreign Military Intelligence Service. He led a double life, charming German ambassadors in Tokyo and earning their trust to the point of gaining access to classified diplomatic intelligence, all the while sending reports to his Soviet handlers. Sorge's reports of German-Japanese military plans were so valuable to Russia that he likely prevented the Soviet Union's collapse during the war. While most spies did little more than collect inconsequential intelligence and warn their superiors of small attacks, Sorge's efforts directly impacted the decisions of Russia's military command. His contributions are best described by the English author Friedrich Forsyth. The spies in history who can say from their graves, "The information I supplied to my masters, for better or for worse, altered the history of our planet," can be counted on the fingers of one hand. Richard Sorge was in that group. His career spanned the years immediately preceding the Cold War. The United States and Russia began their arms races in science, weapons, arsenals, and espionage. The CIA and the KGB were formed mostly as an outgrowth of World War II nuclear espionage. They gathered information through paid informants, double agents, communications interceptions, and other means of surveillance. Such spycraft bore little resemblance to the Ian Fleming novels that popularized the conception of this profession. Besting one's opponent at a roulette table, drinking a martini, betting exotic women, then fighting off dozens of henchmen were far less common than meeting to undisclosed locations and sleepless nights for fear of a 3 a.m. visit from the secret police. Also, spies were much less often a secretive type. The success of their mission hinged on them looking and behaving like normal members of society. Richard Sorge lived this contradictory life effortlessly. It came naturally to him, as his life was already a paradox. During World War I, he was a common soldier who fought for the German army and was wounded 3 times. After the war, he became an avowed communist and sought to bring down Germany's military, but his wounds earned the trust of German officers with whom he fraternized in Tokyo. He lived the reckless, indiscreet life of an alcoholic and seduced an ambassador's wife, but this recklessness somehow immunized him from suspicion. Surely, such a careless individual could not run a covert operation. He was so trusted by the German embassy, of which he and his spying were well informed, that they learned of his expertise and even allowed him to use the embassy's codebooks. He warned Russia of impending German attacks daily, which Stalin only took as a provocation and, to his regret, ignored. Although he was Russia's greatest spy, Sergei was completely disavowed upon his capture in order to cover up the Soviet Union's mistakes. Even though his life bore little resemblance to James Bond's, his success as a spy was at least acknowledged by 007's creator. Ian Fleming, also a World War II intelligence officer, considered him the most formidable spy in history. The sentiment was shared by Douglas MacArthur, who thought him a devastating example of brilliant success at espionage. If nothing else, he had James Bond's capacity for drinking and womanizing. In this episode, I'm going to be looking at the careers of 3 different spies. The first is Richard Sorge, the second is Nancy Wake, who fought in the French Resistance, and the third is George Koval, the Soviet nuclear spy from Sioux City, Iowa. I'm focusing on spycraft during World War II. Now, spies have been a feature of state security and military intelligence since the beginning of warfare. The 13th century BC Old Testament narrative of the Jewish Exodus is largely shaped by spies gathering intelligence from foreign lands. In Greek and Roman military chronicles, spies are referenced as much as cavalry commanders, phalanx troops, or archers. And even the honey trap, a staple of modern-day spy fiction, appears throughout the ancient world. Thanks to the James Bond and Jason Bourne franchises, everyone has at least some conception of intelligence services and espionage, no matter how exaggerated these sources might be. Unfortunately, most elements of the fictionalized versions of spying are false, no doubt to the disappointment of many CIA recruits. Intelligence typically isn't gathered by wearing tuxedos, drinking martinis, and mission objectives typically don't involve infiltration of an underground compound beneath a volcano or preventing an eccentric billionaire from striking the eastern seaboard with nerve toxin. But the importance of espionage for national security is no fiction. Entire wars have been won or lost according to these secret activities. America's first elite clandestine unit, Knowlton's Rangers, undertook missions for George Washington that would have made Sun Tzu proud. They fooled British generals into moving on Concord in 1775 by planning false intelligence reports that the Continental Army stored its munitions there. In 1781, they leaked intelligence that a Franco-American assault on New York was imminent. The British Army strengthened its position for an attack that never materialized, moving precious troops and supply lines from important battle locations. This is a major reason Lord Cornwallis was defeated at the underdefended Yorktown in Virginia. Certain periods in history have been more conducive to spying than others. These are typically times when large nations or empires battle one another. Often, when 2 states with enormous militaries and bureaucracies are fighting for supremacy, massive funds are allocated toward espionage, and there's plenty of work to be found. I'm focusing on World War II in this episode, and there's plenty of other time periods I could have focused on where there's plenty of spying going around. World War I, the 19th century. I could go back to Elizabethan times, where Elizabeth had her own spy ring that gathered intelligence about the impending invasion of the Spanish Armada. But I'm focusing on the Second World War because there are new things that happen in warfare. With atomic weapons programs, it was never more important to steal enemy intelligence on how to develop a weapon if that weapon in question could take out an entire city. Also, knowing troop movements, which has always been important, is very important now. With a large-scale amphibious assault like D-Day, if you can't prevent it, you could very well lose the war, as Erwin Rommel commented that Germany would very well likely do if they couldn't prevent an Allied invasion of the European mainland. But let's return to the life of Richard Sorge. Sorge was born on October 4, 1895, in Baku, a Caspian port city in modern-day Azerbaijan, to a German mining engineer, Wilhelm Richard Sorge, and his Russian wife, Nina Kobieleva. He was the youngest of 9 children. Sorge's father was a staunch supporter of the Kaiser and worked for an oil company. His lucrative contract expired a few years later, and they left the Caucasus to return to Germany in 1898. Richard was raised in a cosmopolitan household and bore all the hallmarks of respectable German society. He had a privileged education and studied at a gymnasium in the suburbs of Berlin, and that doesn't mean that he was doing ring curls or the pommel horse, but a type of school. When World War I broke out, the young Sergei, who is still in high school, enlisted in the German army and joined a student battalion fighting on the Western Front in an artillery regiment before transferring to the Eastern Front the next year. He was a brave soldier who charged into heavy gunfire and was wounded on three occasions. This injury gave him a slight limp for the rest of his life. In March 1916, on the third occasion, he lost three fingers and broke both legs due to shrapnel. He was given a medical discharge after being awarded a promotion and the Iron Cross, second class. While he was recovering, Sergei began reading Karl Marx, who his great uncle had worked with while also serving as Secretary General of the First International when it came to New York in the 1870s. Richard also came under the influence of the Marxist father of a nurse whom he had seduced. The message resonated strongly with the young soldier. He was disillusioned with the fiercely nationalistic fervor that swept through Germany and with the war fought between two capitalistic empires that slaughtered 2 million of his countrymen. 25 years later, he told his Japanese captors, "Even if I never had been motivated by other considerations, the World War alone would have been enough to make me a communist." He wasn't fit to return to the front line, so Sergei was allowed to attend the University of Berlin and later the University of Kiev. He became a communist and decided not only to study, but also to take part in the organized revolutionary movement, he said. Sergei obtained a PhD in political science in 1919 from the University of Hamburg and joined the local branch of the German Communist Party the same year. He had all the zeal of a new convert and taught its tenets to his students. Along with German coal miners with whom he had taken a job in order to organize clandestine communist cells. His political views caused him to be terminated as a teacher, as communism was viewed as a competing ideology with fascism, which reigned in Weimar Germany. He developed Soviet contacts in 1924 when a delegate at a secret KDP, or German Communist Party, meeting in Frankfurt invited him to Moscow. National police labeled him a spy. Fearing arrest, he fled for the Soviet Union. There, he met Dmitry Manulisky, head of intelligence for the Comintern, an organization with the goal of spreading communism throughout the world. He began Sergei's training as a spy by encouraging him to learn French, English, and Russian. Sergei developed a cover as a journalist, which allowed him to travel unsuspected to many European countries. His mission was to determine the potential for communist revolutions in other nations as it occurred in Russia. After training in espionage, he returned to Germany, where he met Christian Gerlach, a former librarian at the University of Frankfurt. When they met, she was the wife of Sergei's former economics instructor. She left her husband to live with Sergei in Solingen, which was considered scandalous behavior in Germany at the time. He married Gerlach in 1922. Reluctantly, as the two disliked bourgeoisie marriage, what they considered a form of class oppression, although his wife was not aware of his spy work. She was taken by the handsome and charismatic young man, as were many other women. Sergei carried on numerous affairs, often with the wives of his old professors or co-workers. Gerlach wrote years later of her first sight of him. "It was as if a stroke of lightning ran through me. In this one second, something awoke in me that had slumbered until now. Something dangerous, dark, inescapable. He was tall and magnetic, with piercing blue eyes." This image of Sergei as a playboy who frequented fashionable cocktail parties has stuck with filmmakers in their depiction of the famous spy. During his Tokyo years, he frequented the red light district and rode his motorcycle at breakneck speeds on its roadways, whether sober or drunk. According to Japanese and Nazi surveillance reports released after his death, he maintained steady contacts with 52 women in Japan. The longest relationship he had was with Hanako Ishii, a 26-year-old waitress. This lifestyle worked to his advantage as a spy. An American journalist and drinking companion said that he created the impression of being a playboy, almost a wastrel, the very antithesis of a keen and dangerous spy. Sergei moved to Frankfurt, became a member of the International Liaison Department of the Comintern, and developed foreign contacts with Communist Party members. They sent him to Britain to investigate the labor movement, the status of the Communist Party of Great Britain, and its political and economic conditions. Sergei's handlers in Soviet intelligence instructed him to remain undercover during his fact-finding mission. He preferred developing his own contacts and avoiding local communist parties, which were more rigidly doctrinal. He reached an agreement with his Soviet superiors to transmit information directly to Moscow and avoid local leftists. Sergei had transformed from a communist agent into a Soviet spy. Sergei continues undercover work in Germany, where he became a member of the Nazi Party in late 1929. In order to establish his cover, he assumed the identity of China correspondent for the agricultural newspaper Gertrude Zeitung, Grain News. The cover provided a pretense for his frequent traveling and an excuse to form contacts with high-level military and government officials. Although he had no background in agriculture, it was not uncommon for journalists to cover a beat in which they had little expertise. In 1930, Sergei was then ordered to Shanghai to support a communist revolution. At his new posting, he gathered information on Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek and his associates by posing as an expert in Chinese agriculture. He traveled throughout the nation and met with communist organizations. Sergei soon struck up friendship with another German advising the premier, Colonel Hermann von Kriebel, an easy feat for the disabled war hero. He also made contact with a number of other communist spies and sympathizers, such as Max Clausen and Agnes Smedley, an American correspondent for the Frankfurter Zeitung, whom he met in a left-wing Shanghai bookshop. Smedley, who became his lover, introduced Sergei to Taichi Kawai and Hotsumi Ozaki, who was a journalist from a Japanese newspaper, Asahi Shimbun, and Japan's best-informed China analyst. Both Japanese nationals became part of Sergei's growing spy ring. They fed him intelligence on China's military preparations against a Japanese attack. After Japan's conquest of Manchuria in 1931-1932, Russia feared a Japanese attack on the Soviet Far East. Sergei was tasked with watching for military deployments to signal an invasion, and this was his primary task for the next decade. Around 1932, Chinese intelligence suspected the agricultural expert of being a spy. Sergei focused exclusively on his newspaper reporting to allay suspicions. Ironically, members of Chiang Kai-shek's military circle liked Sergei's reporting and met with him on a number of occasions, providing him with the valuable information that he passed on to his communist handlers. Sergei returned to Russia in late 1932 and received significant praise for his work. He was sent to Japan in September 1933 to set up a spy ring and learn of Japan's military preparations for an invasion of China. It was no small assignment. Japan was viewed by the international intelligence community as an impenetrable shell from which nothing leaked. They gave him the hardest task in the intelligence service: penetrate the interior of the Japanese leadership and learn of its master plan for East Asia. He needed to develop a more convincing cover. Since he could never pass as a Japanese citizen, Sergei shored up his German bona fides to appeal to national sentiments surrounding the Japan-German military alliance. Being a correspondent for a Grain newspaper would do neither. While in Germany, he stopped in Berlin to obtain a German passport and a commission from two Nazi newspapers to report on events in Japan. From Professor Karl Haushofer, considered the grandfather of geopolitics, he received a letter of introduction to a German army officer, Colonel Eugen Ott, the new military attaché in Tokyo, and another World War I veteran. "You can rely on Sergei in every respect, politically and personally," Haushofer wrote. Sergei arrived in Japan on September 6 aboard a Canadian Pacific liner. His spy cell initially consisted of Comintern agent and Yugoslav communist Branko Vukelic, a journalist working for a French magazine, Vue, who handled microfilm work for Sergei. Also in the ring were Yotoki Miyagi, a Japanese journalist for the English-language newspaper Japan Advertiser and respected expert on China. Rounding out the ring were radio operator Bernhardt and journalist Hotsumi Ozaki. Vukelic would photograph documents, and Yotoku would gather information from Sergei's old contacts. Bernhardt did not last long as a radio operator due to his heavy drinking and negligence on the job. He was later recalled to the Soviet Union. The ring sent messages to Moscow using a numerical code and one-time pad. It was a virtually unbreakable system that relied on a random secret key. His new operator was Max Clausen, who worked under the alias of a blueprints producer. The adroit technician built his own transmitter from parts he purchased in Tokyo shops, and he relayed messages to his controllers in Vladivostok. Even when Japanese authorities discovered the unauthorized radio transmissions, they could not locate their source or decipher the code. Officials knew a spy was in their midst, but they did not know who or where. Sorge constructed an information pipeline with Japanese officials, German consular agents, and businessmen on one end, and Soviet intelligence officers on the other. In 1932, it began trickling in, but gushed upon the addition of Shanghai Weekly correspondent Taikichi Kawai to his cell. Kawai passed on information he obtained from Japanese army personnel, which Sorge hand-delivered to Russia before finding a reliable radio operator in Klausen. In 1935, Sorge met with the 4th Bureau Command and showed them detailed personnel charts of the Japanese military officials and each one's views of the Soviet Union. Despite growing information leaks, the German government still thought of Sorge as a loyal patriot and a Nazi Party member. He developed close relations with the important embassy officials, including Eugen Ott and Ambassador Herbert von Dirksen. In October 1934, Ott invited him on a tour of Manchuria. Sorge wrote a report, which Ott forwarded to Berlin, where it won praise among the high command. In February 1936, the German embassy asked him to provide information about Japan's political and military climate. The German embassy gave Sorge access to classified intelligence and even told him about the planned alliance between Germany and Japan. To put together a convincing cover as an open-minded journalist, Sorge did not pretend to be an unflinching supporter of the Nazi Party, allowing some of his earnest anti-nationalist sentiments to surface. Ironically, this increases credibility. When he voiced scorn for the excesses of the Nazi Party and certain party members, his German associates thought him to be expressing constructive criticism rather than anger. To them, he was a scholar and patriot whose old war wounds made him suspicious of any armed conflict. They were so enchanted by him that when Sorge was discovered in bed with Helma Ott, the colonel's wife, the cuckolded husband chose to overlook it, believing that it would soon blow over. Ott placed too low a value on his marriage to let the matter trouble him, and he placed too high a value on the reporter's insights to let the matter ruin their friendship. And he may have been too entertaining a friend to lose. A life with afternoons at the park of the Tokyo Imperial Hotel and evenings at the Rheingold made Sorge an ideal boon companion. But also made him a ticking time bomb. Why did he engage in such risky behavior and severe alcoholism when a slip of the tongue in a drunken stupor could lead to his death? Robert Wyman argues that Stalin was in the middle of purging tens of thousands of officers and high-level Communist Party members. The multilingual were specifically targeted by the semi-educated Stalin. With the signing of the 1939 Nazi-Soviet Pact, Sorge may have worried that the two nations shared lists of each other's embedded spies. Perhaps drink was a way to offset his boiling inner tensions. In 1936, Ott was promoted to Major General and became Germany's ambassador to Japan. Goldman notes that this further enhanced Sorge's standing with the German embassy. He saw drafts of Ott's cables and reports, asking his opinion before transmitting them to Berlin. Any major development was run by Sorge before the embassy developed official policy. According to Gestapo Colonel Joseph Meisinger, the embassy's police attaché, the relationship between Ott and Sorge was now so close that all normal reports from attachés to Berlin became mere appendages to the overall report written by Sorge and signed by the ambassador. He helped code and decode secret telegrams to Berlin, which at this time lured Japan into an Axis alliance. Other state secrets Sorge transmitted, including Japanese personnel charts of military officials, information about the Anti-Comintern Pact in 1936, essentially an anti-Soviet treaty, the German-Japanese Pact in 1940, and even Japanese plans to attack Pearl Harbor. These treaties all pointed toward a two-pronged German-Japanese attack on Russia. He kept his superiors informed of every step by Japan and stopped intelligence leaks from threatening the Soviet war effort. One such effort was General Genrikh Lyushkov crossing the border into Manchuria in June 1936 to avoid Stalin's purge of the military leadership. Sorge obtained the embassy's copy of this classified report and learned of Lyushkov claiming to his captors that if Japan struck Russia, it could collapse in a day. He offered Japan information on Soviet military deployments and codes. Sorge informed Moscow, which promptly changed them. The threat of German-Japanese anti-Soviet alliances caused Stalin to counter this threat by aligning with Hitler in 1939 and signing the German-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact. After the signing, World War II broke out the next week. Sergei began hearing whispers about a planned German attack on the Soviet Union. He saw reports by late 1940 of a large-scale military buildup near Soviet borders. On May 6, 1941, Sergei sent the following dispatch. Possibility of outbreak of war at any time is very high. German generals estimate the Red Army's fighting capacity is so low, it will be destroyed in the course of a few weeks. He sent another dispatch on June 1st that Hitler is planning an invasion with 170 to 190 units massed on the Soviet border. Expected start of German-Soviet war around June 15th is based on information by Lieutenant Colonel Scholl, brought with him from Berlin, for Ambassador Ott. His Soviet superiors did not believe the report. They wrote, "Suspicious," to be listed with telegrams intended as provocations. Neither did Joseph Stalin. The thought of Germany attacking at that time was inconceivable due to his faith in Russia and Germany's eternal pact of friendship. Sergei tried once more on June 20th with the warning that Ott told me that war between Germany and the USSR is inevitable. Ozaki told me that the Japanese General Staff is already discussing what position to take in the event of war. Stalin still ignored the warning, or perhaps pretended to, since there was nothing he could do about it at this point. He preferred to trust his instincts rather than leaked state secrets, a mistake he most likely regretted but never publicly acknowledged. When Sergei heard the report on June 22, 1941, that Germany invaded the Soviet Union in Operation Barbarossa, he fell into a black mood. He had spent the day driving through the countryside with his latest fling, German pianist Etta Harik Schneider. Upon hearing shouts from newsboys on the street about Germany's invasion, he knew that Stalin had ignored his reports. Stuart Goldman relates in his book that during the Soviet-Japanese conflict in the 1930s, Sergei attempted to drink his misery away. At the bar of the Imperial Hotel, he quickly became drunk and shouted curses against Germany in English. "Hitler's an effing criminal! A murderer!" he yelled. "But Stalin will teach the bastard a lesson. You just wait and see." The onlookers stared at him in confusion. Neither his drinking companion nor the barman could calm him. He then called the German embassy from a public telephone in the lobby. "The war is lost," he shouted to Eugen Ott. Well, the next 5 months were disastrous for Russia with Operation Barbarossa, and to make a long story short, Russia did not ignore Sergei any longer, especially since Russia was on the brink of collapse, and there was no way they could handle two-front war. Fortunately for Russia, Japan was also constrained by its military options. It was heavily invested in its Chinese war effort and had limited means to fight on another front. One option was to attack the Soviet Far East, which they knew was weak. Another was to invade the European colonies in Southeast Asia, where French, British, and Dutch-administered states were filled with oil and raw materials vital to the war effort. They chose to attack south, first in French Indochina, which they occupied in July, but also build up strength in northern Japan to strike north if the Soviet army was defeated. Japan amassed hundreds of thousands of troops on the Manchurian border, but high command decided not to attack in 1941. Sergei passed this information to his superiors. He also saw no harm in sharing it with Ott, who gave it to German intelligence. This was the spy's greatest accomplishment, and his acquisition of these plans arguably saved Russia from complete military annihilation. He provided this information to Moscow only a week after the German attack, but this time Sergei's advice was closely heeded, with Stalin himself reading the full report. In September, Sergei radioed Moscow that a Japanese attack against the USSR was now out of the question, and Russia's Far Eastern forces would be completely free after September 15th. Japanese unwillingness to engage the Soviet Union in warfare allowed Russia to move army divisions from the Manchurian border, freeing them to help Russia during the Battle of Moscow. Stalin moved 1,700 tanks, 3 cavalry divisions, 15 infantry divisions, and 1,500 aircraft from the Siberian divisions to the European front, stopping the German blitzkrieg at the gates of the Soviet capital. The reallocation of these resources bolstered the Eastern Front, presenting a major obstacle to German advancement. It was the first major tactical defeat for the Germans in World War II. The cracks in Sergei's spy network had begun to form even before the war began. In January 1936, Taikichi Kawai was arrested for espionage. Although he was tortured for over 6 months, he refused to give the Japanese secret police any information. Kawai was eventually released. In October 1941, Miyagi was arrested and interrogated for several days after a dressmaker, whom he had recruited, gave up his name. He withstood torture at first, but eventually attempted suicide in order to save his colleagues by jumping out of a second-story window. Miyagi eventually admitted that he was part of a Soviet spy ring and gave the Japanese secret police the names of his contacts. Officers then arrested Hotsumi, torturing a confession out of him. On October 18, 1941, Sergei, Clausen, and Vukelich were all arrested in a sweep by the secret police. During the arrest, they found messages that Clausen was preparing to send to Moscow. Sergei withstood torture for 6 days, but eventually confessed to his clandestine activities. He was held in prison for 3 years at Tokyo's Sugamo Prison before being convicted of espionage and attempting to overthrow the emperor. He hoped to be exchanged for a Japanese prisoner held by the Soviet Union and even wrote a 4-volume confession to raise his own value for a trade. Russian officials refused to acknowledge Sergei. Japanese officers made 3 attempts at a trade, but each time the Soviet embassy in Tokyo gave the same response. The man called Richard Sergei is unknown to us. Sergei was a persona non grata. He was given a death sentence in 1943. Sergei was hanged on November 7, 1944, along with Ozaki. His existence was disavowed at the time because it reminded Stalin of his embarrassing refusal to heed his warnings of a German attack. Sergei's wife, Katya Maximova, remained in Russia but was arrested in 1942, falsely accused of being a German spy. She was executed, most likely as a way to clean up the Sergei affair. Sergei was an embarrassment to the Soviet leadership in the final days of the war, but he began to receive posthumous recognition following Joseph Stalin's death in 1953. In 1954, West German filmmaker and former Nazi propagandist Veit Harlan wrote and directed Betrayal of Germany about Sergei's spy activities in Japan. In 1961, the movie Who Are You, Mr. Sergei? Was produced in France in collaboration with Japan, Italy, and West Germany. Nikita Khrushchev, upon seeing the film, asked his officials if the story was true. When they responded that it was, he named Sergei a hero of the Soviet state in 1964, the 20th anniversary of his death. A commemorative postage stamp was issued in 1965 and spread throughout the Soviet Empire. His other widow, Hanako Ishii, received a Soviet pension until her death in July 2000. A Moscow street was named after him, and historians now universally acknowledge him as one of the most important spies of the 20th century. As noted by Wymont, Sergei's life was full of contradictions. His information made it safe for the Soviets to transfer troops from the Japanese to German front, finally stemming the tide of Axis victory when they crashed against the wall of Russian resistance. However, although he helped stop Hitler, the ultimate benefactor from his spying may have been the West. For all his efforts, he was disowned and executed. Most of all, he was a spy who penetrated the hard shell of Japanese society and found it to be soft inside.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.
Okay, so that was the life of Richard Sergei. Now I want to shift gears and focus on a different type of spy. If Sergei was getting into the inner workings of diplomatic channels and finding high intelligence, another sort is Nancy Wake, who worked with the French Resistance, who was on the front lines, smuggling soldiers in and out of Nazi-occupied France. Different part of spycraft, to be sure, but it's good to see a different angle of it to see how different this type of work could really be. So let's move from the Eastern Front to the Western Front in World War II. And our time period is on the eve of D-Day in June 6, 1944. For British Royal Air officers, they knew that the best hope for weakening German lines in anticipation of D-Day was to supply the French resistance, because a two-pronged assault on the Nazi army would be the first step in squeezing the Germans into submission. But to determine the best drop points for weapons and supply caches, they needed information from a resistance leader himself. They consulted the MI6 for information on a reliable contact. The request was acknowledged, and a file folder was sent to the officers. When they looked at the sepia-toned photo on the first page, they were shocked. Gazing back at them was a brunette bombshell with a firm jaw and dark eyes. The picture looked like a headshot for a Hollywood starlet, direct from Central Casting to star opposite Cary Grant in a screwball comedy. But they were even more surprised to learn that this New Zealand-born, high-society hostess-turned-heroine of the French Resistance had led a guerrilla army of 7,000 men, blown up German supply depots, bicycled hundreds of miles nonstop over mountains to deliver critical intelligence, and even killed a man with her bare hands. But for Nancy Wake, the resistance leader, killing one's enemy was nothing to get worked up about. She once said, "I don't see why we women should just wave our men a proud goodbye and then knit for them. In my opinion, the only good German was a dead German, and the deader, the better. I killed a lot of Germans, and I am only sorry I didn't kill more." Nancy Wake was a World War II spy and saboteur who operated behind enemy lines to organize the French resistance, helping soldiers and escaped prisoners flee the country. German intelligence dubbed her the White Mouse for her ability to escape capture. Between 1940 and 1943, she saved hundreds of Allied soldiers and downed airmen by bringing them through occupied France and into Spain. She also established communication lines between the French resistance and the British military, being critical in weakening Germany in anticipation of the invasion of Normandy. She was a saboteur, organizer, and resistance fighter who led a number of raids and was recognized for her bravery by both Allied governments and the men with whom she fought. She became the most decorated woman in the war. Her movie star appearance hit a tough metal, and the discontinuity between the two helped Wake bluff her way through many dangerous encounters with German guards. She also had difficulty convincing allies of her deadly ability, something that was noted by resistance fighter Henry Tardevat, who said that she was the most feminine woman I know until the fighting starts. Then she is like five men. The Nazis were infuriated by her attacks and sabotage. They offered a bounty of 5 million francs for her capture, pushing her to the top of the Gestapo's most wanted list. She was so adept at juggling false identities that the full strength of Nazi surveillance could not incriminate her. For her bravery in the resistance, she received numerous medals, including Britain's George Medal, the United States' second highest civilian honor, the Medal of Freedom, and from France, the Medal de la Résistance, the Croix de Guerre, and its highest honor, the Legion of Honor. Well, let's back up to her early life. Nancy Wake was born on August 30th, 1912, in Wellington, New Zealand. She was the youngest of six children, and at age 20, she received an inheritance and traveled to America, then London, and finally to Paris, where she learned French and started working as a reporter, but most of all enjoying the Parisian nightlife. She made a number of friends with independent and carefree youth, and her life was a whirlwind of high society and dinners at chic bistros. She was rarely found at night without a double gin and tonic in her hand, Wake's preferred drink throughout her life. While witnessing Hitler's rise to power while in Vienna, working for the Hearst group of newspapers, she came to Austria's capital to interview the Führer, which she did in 1933, and reported on Nazi brutality described by German refugees. Wake may have thought these reports to be exaggerations, but she was horrified to see Nazi gangs randomly beating Jewish men and women in the streets. Some acts of brutality approached that of medieval public shaming, with Jews whipped by Nazi stormtroopers in a city square. According to her 1985 autobiography, The White Mouse, she underwent a metamorphosis from a socialite who loved nothing more than a good drink and handsome men, especially French men, into the fighter she would become. Wake promised to herself that if the opportunity arose, she would do everything in her power to stop the Nazis, or at least muddle their plans. In 1936, she met Henri Fiocca. He was a wealthy French industrialist from Marseille, with a love for tango dancing and a reputation as a playboy. The two married in 1939 and briefly led a life of luxury in the final days of pre-war France, filled with caviar and champagne. The couple were the epitome of glamour. They resided in a luxurious apartment on a hill in Marseille, overlooking the city and its harbor. 6 months after they were married, Germany invaded France. France quickly surrendered. the southern part of the country became a nominally independent Nazi satellite, with Nazi soldiers flooding the city. Wake started active involvement in the resistance movement. She used her elite status and wealth to avoid detection in the early stages of the guerrilla movement, using her cover as a socialite now perfectly fluent in French. At the same time, she assembled a crude underground smuggling network. It came about when she met a British officer who had been trapped in France when it fell. She invited him and his two soldiers to her flat for dinner. Wake then gave them a radio to listen to the BBC's broadcast. In the weeks ahead, this act of hosting transformed into providing them a stream of provisions and supplies, along with 200 of their comrades. These efforts led to her work as a courier for Captain Ian Garrow, a Scot who created an escape route for Royal Air Force pilots and officers from Vichy, France across the Pyrenees into Spain. Wake smuggled food and messages between various factions of the underground groups. She also helped Allied servicemen and Jewish refugees escape the advancing German army by transporting them in an ambulance that she purchased for this purpose. Smuggling became more difficult when Nazis occupied southern France in 1942. Prior to this date, Wake and Fiocca operated with little scrutiny. But to remain in Vichy, France, she had to obtain false papers. She made frequent train trips to the Spanish border to spirit soldiers outside enemy lines, giving them forged papers, ID cards, new clothes, and false identities, throwing off any German suspicions as to the reason of their trip. To pass through German checkpoints, the slender, dark-haired woman brazenly flirted with Nazi soldiers. She used her husband's family's chalet at Nevach in the Alps as a safe house. She also used all her wits to save those who fell into capture. When her Scottish handler was imprisoned in a concentration camp, she bribed a guard to secure his escape. These efforts continued for 2 years, but she sensed the noose tightening around her. Her work became increasingly dangerous as the Gestapo suspected her of resistance involvement. They tapped her phone and opened her mail, but could not incriminate her due to her expert juggling of multiple identities and never harboring evidence with which she could be indicted. Chatter increased among the Gestapo of La Souris Blanche, the White Mouse. Embedded in French society, hiding in plain sight, who escorted Allied servicemen out of the nation. She always allayed suspicions with her cunning and guile. She said, "It was much easier for us, you know, to travel all over France," she said to an Australian television interviewer many years later. "A woman could get out of a lot of trouble that a man could not." By 1943, she was number one on the Gestapo's most wanted list. They offered a 5 million franc award on her head. British spymasters intercepted the order for her arrest and saw the capture was imminent. With the trap being set, the French resistance told Wake it was too dangerous for her in France. They advised her to seek asylum in Britain before the Gestapo kicked down her door in the middle of the night. Her husband agreed. When news came that Nazi officers were coming to arrest her, she kissed Henry for the last time, telling him she had to do some shopping and that she would be back soon. They never saw each other again. She attempted to cross the Pyrenees into Spain. It was the first of six such attempts. On one attempt, she was captured in Toulouse while waiting the escape circuit to extricate her from Malice, a militia run by Vichy France and allied with the Germans. Wake was interrogated for 4 days, but maintained her innocence and refused to divulge any information, not even her name. She was eventually released after Patrick O'Leary, whose real name was Albert Garis, a Belgian resistance member who also organized escape routes for downed Allied pilots and who replaced Garrow in the role, convinced her captors that Wake was a friend of the Vichy premier and O'Leary's mistress. He told the Malice that her false testimony was merely a trick to deceive her husband. She was set free. In her sixth and final attempt to escape France, she was forced to jump from a moving train through the window as Germans fired upon her in the darkness. Wake ran through a vineyard for concealment. She finally reached Spain when two Americans and a New Zealander buried her in the back of a coal truck, which drove slowly through the mountain roads of the Pyrenees. Wake arrived in England shortly after on a ship from Gibraltar. She had no news of her husband. Thinking him trapped behind enemy lines or deeply involved in the resistance, she itched to return to France. Unknown to her until the war finished, he had been captured, tortured, and killed by the Germans, refusing to give up his wife's location. Once in England, British intelligence decided that with her perfect French, placement within the resistance, connection to underground guerrilla movements, an indefatigable spirit, she had far too much potential to remain a simple courier. They chose to train Wake for more dangerous assignments in guerrilla command. The White Mouse courier was transformed into a resistance leader of the Maquis, the rural French resistance fighters. Under the command of Colonel Buckmaster, she became a member of the French section of the British Special Operations Executive, SOE, formed in 1940 by Winston Churchill and created to coordinate efforts with anti-German resistance groups. Those in the organization knew the SOE as the Baker Street Irregulars, and a cover organization for its female division was the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry. She trained as a spy at the British Ministry of Defense. For weeks, she was drilled by instructors who ran the women through their paces. Challenges included obstacle courses and survival, and escape scenarios that tested their creativity and intelligence. Wake conquered them all. She was then sent to Scotland to learn advanced spycraft. Here, she was trained in night parachuting, radio operation, cryptography, enemy identification, guerrilla fighting, and other forms of security instruction. She also learned the use of plastic explosives, Sten guns, grenades, pistols and rifles, rig detonators and explosives, and the ability to construct explosives using ingredients from pharmacies and hardware stores, and to kill silently. Wake was given a cover story and a code name, Helene, and told to come up with a personal ID code. She chose a dirty limerick. Once her training was complete, Wake and Major John Farmer, another SOE operative, were parachuted into central France on April 29, 1944, to make contact with the resistance bands. The 31-year-old was among 430 men and 39 women sent to assist with preparations for D-Day. She jumped from a B-24 bomber with nothing on her person but a pistol, a radio, and cash. Her parachute was tangled in a tree when she came down. Henri Tardivat, the resistance fighter, greeted her with a bon mot. "I hope that all the trees in France bear such beautiful fruit this year." She linked with a small cell of the Maquis and took command. Their mission was to help the resistance weaken the ability of the German army to respond to an Allied attack. To do this, Wake and Farmer needed to organize parachute drops with arms and weapons caches, as well as establish radio communication with the Royal Air Force. She collected night drops of ammunition for bazookas, hand grenades, and Sten guns 4 times a week, hiding them in storage caches for the advancing soldiers to replenish their ammunition and arms. She set up wireless communication with England, ensuring that radio operatives had contact with the SOE, and prepared strikes on the Germans to divert their attention. At first, Wake's command was resisted by a Maquis leader named Gaspard. He ignored orders from London and refused to employ the guerrilla tactics for their situation, dangerously gathering all his men in one location rather than defusing them. She took charge after a German attack killed 150 of Gaspard's men, scattering the rest over southern France. Wake told the remaining Maquis they would be fed and armed only if they followed her instruction. She alone knew the plans for D-Day and the timetable for supply drops. They didn't have much of a choice, and within months, she was a high-level Maquis officer. Wake led them in attacks against German convoys, troops, and installations. She was constantly on the move, hiding from patrols in the forest and meeting with resistance fighters. She trained and motivated them, planning assaults on German factories and communications. Most of all, she inspired the soldiers as a former socialite who accepted that war had transformed her life into chaos and uncertainty, fearlessly throwing herself into the face of death. Her risk of capture was dangerous to the point of being suicidal. Wake operated in an area filled with 22,000 German troops. The French resistance fighters only had 3,000 to 4,000 men. As she carried on preparations for D-Day, Wake began vigorous recruitment efforts along with Gaspard. The number of resistance fighters soon swelled to over 7,000. In addition to organizing supplies, Wake was personally involved in combat. The weapons drop for the Maquis became more sophisticated, and 2 American weapons instructors were sent with a supply drop. They helped the rebels launch more deadly attacks. Wake led a number of these attacks on German positions, including a raid on the Gestapo headquarters in Montsoon, leaving 38 Germans dead. She said, "It was the most exciting sortie I ever made. I entered the building by the back door, raced up the stairs, opened the first door along the passageway, threw in my grenades, and ran like hell." On one such raid, Wake killed a sentry of a gun factory with a single chop to the neck to keep him from alerting the other guards. On another occasion, her resistance group captured a female German spy whom they were unwilling to kill. But Wake had no time for such sentimentality. She executed the spy herself, but let the other innocent girls go. The Germans were determined to stop the attacks. To squeeze intelligence out of collaborators or sympathizers, they took hostages executed French citizens, and burnt buildings. With the Allied invasion imminent, the Nazi army tried to wipe out them once for all. Wake's resistance stronghold was centered on a small town on a plateau. German troops surrounded the plateau with mortars, artillery, mobile guns, and aircraft. Over 22,000 SS troops attacked the 7,000 Maquis in June 1944. They could not overcome the French resistance fighters due to the latter's superior position, better knowledge of the terrain, and superior tactics. 1,400 German soldiers died versus 100 resistance fighters. A famous story relates that Wake rode a bicycle over 250 miles to replace codes that had to be eliminated when a German counterattacked their assault. Wake's radio was destroyed when the truck she was driving was blown up by a Nazi bomber aerial assault. It failed to stop them, but Wake's wireless operator, Dennis Rake, burned the codebooks when capture appeared imminent. The new codes were necessary to organize parachute drops of fresh supplies that were critical before D-Day. To get a new transmitting radio to reestablish contact with London, she stole a bicycle and rode the distance for almost 71 non-stop hours, passing through a number of German checkpoints, which going 71 hours straight would make just about anyone but a professional cyclist faint. The grueling bicycle effort to replace the vital codes was what Wake later reflected to be her most important contribution to the war effort. She said, "When I got off that damn bike, I felt as if I had a fire between my legs. I couldn't stand up. I couldn't sit down. I couldn't walk. When I'm asked what I'm most proud of during the war, I say, the bike ride." Now, just as an aside with her story, with the fearless and beautiful Wake at the command of so many male soldiers, film and television producers have speculated that she carried on many love affairs. The theory is plausible. After all, she was in France, and she reportedly challenged the men under her command to drinking contests to earn their respect, and often drinking them under the table since she had so many years of experience with double gin and tonics. Wake insisted in later years that she did not have a single affair throughout the war. She describes it as sharing a platonic pact of love with her fellow soldiers, similar to Joan of Arc, that was born purely out of camaraderie and respect toward a brother or sister in arms. She says that it was a decision that avoided complications that may have threatened the resistance effort, because she was too busy killing Nazis to take on paramours, and she believed her husband to still be alive. She said in one interview years later, "But you see, if I had accommodated one man, the word would have spread around and I would have had to accommodate the whole damn lot." Fast forwarding to D-Day, the Allies began the liberation of Europe on June 6, 1944. They attacked from the beaches of Normandy and the Maquis attacked from the other side of enemy lines, cutting telephone lines and destroying factories. For the remainder of the war, she ambushed German convoys and bombed railway lines and bridges. She continued the resistance effort with unwavering tenacity, even though French liberation appeared on the horizon. When 10 men in her camp refused to perform water-carrying duties, she emptied a bucket on each of their heads. On August 25, 1944, the Allies liberated Paris. Wake and her resistance fighters joined the march into Vichy to celebrate the victory. Her Maquis comrades paraded in her honor at their chateau-turned-headquarters. But it was a bittersweet victory. She learned that her husband, whom she frequently described as the love of her life, had been arrested, tortured, and killed. News of comrades who fell in battle came to Vichy. Among other SOE operatives, 12 of the 39 women were killed, along with 94 of the men. By the end of the war, 600,000 French had been killed, with over 200,000 imprisoned in concentration camps. So Wake's life after the war was working with British intelligence. She poured herself into her assignments at first, but she quickly became bored with the desk assignment, and being another secretary in an office and serving coffee to wealthy travelers wasn't very satisfying to the decorated war hero. She moved to Australia and then back to London in her life, and in her later years lived at the Stafford Hotel in St. James Place, a British and American forces club during World War II. Most mornings, she saddled up to a leather stool in the hotel and ordered her first of the day's five or six gin and tonics. And her remaining years were spent in Britain or France, where her surviving friends lived, and where she said she felt appreciated, perhaps with a note of indignation that she never received proper recognition from her native Australia. Wake died on August 7, 2011, at the age of 98 from a chest infection. Those around her described her as a spirited woman who channeled her passion into a fearless life that very well pushed the Allied war machine past the tipping point into victory. When interviewed at the age of 89, she was as resolute as ever. She said, "Someone once asked me, have you ever been afraid?" Ha! Never been afraid in my life. All right, so we looked at the career of Richard Sorge, who was operating at the highest levels of diplomatic spying, and then Nancy Wake, who had to bluff guards, centuries of factories and fight on the front lines of resistance. Final person we're going to look at is a different spy, George Koval. He stole nuclear secrets, which was important in World War II, critically important in the Cold War, and probably the most important sort of spycraft that you could do in the middle of the 20th century. As we're going to see, his life very well altered the entire course of the 20th century and the Cold War. And hey, to top things off, he is also from my home state of Iowa. Now let's start off this story with Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin was a former KGB officer who spent the 80s in East Germany recruiting foreigners and sending them undercover to the United States. And if you look online, there's a picture of 80s Vladimir Putin standing right next to Ronald Reagan when Reagan was in Germany doing a meet and greet. So the old KGB officer had a soft spot in his heart for sleeper agents. So it was little surprise on November 2nd, 2007, he honored a recently deceased Cold War deep cover agent with a gold star, designating him a hero of the Russian Federation, the nation's highest civilian honor. This ceremony introduced George Koval to the world. But this was a big surprise to his friends and family, because Russian acquaintances knew Koval as a physics professor, whose career was long and respectable, but unremarkable. Americans knew him as a native Iowan. He was born in Sioux City, educated in Manhattan, and a World War II veteran for the Allies who loved baseball. He was athletic and a genius in technical studies. Once Vladimir Putin knew his cover, hidden for decades in old KGB files and only recently recovered by historians, both Russians and Americans learned his true identity as a man at the top of the pantheon of Soviet spies. His reconnaissance efforts were so far-reaching that they revised decades of the narrative of Cold War espionage. George Koval worked at the Manhattan Project's laboratories in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Dayton, Ohio. He was the only Soviet agent to gain access to the top-secret project. Putin credited him with securing classified intelligence on the most crucial aspect of the atomic bomb, the device that initiates the nuclear reaction. The nuclear secrets he stole reduced by years the time it took Russia to develop nuclear weapons, thus ensuring the preservation of its strategic parity with the United States, which it achieved in 1949. If not for him, four decades of the U.S.-Soviet arms race would have never happened. George Abramovich Koval was born in Sioux City, Iowa in 1913. He was the second of three sons to a family of Jewish immigrants from Belarus, at the time part of the Russian Empire. The city had a large Jewish population and at least half a dozen synagogues. His parents came to Sioux City as part of a massive wave of Russian and Eastern European immigrants to the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century, particularly its Jewish citizens who suffered under Russia's pogroms. The Koval family spoke Belarusian in the home, a language closely related to Russian, but Koval retained an American tinge in his fluent Russian for the rest of his life. His mother and father were ardent communists and supported the Bolshevik Russians. They believed a new regime would right the wrongs of the anti-Semitic Tsarist Russia and remain in contact with family members in the newly formed Soviet Union. And Abraham participated in local communist organizations that flourished in pre-World War II America. In 1924, George's father Abraham became the secretary of the Sioux City branch of I Corps, an organization that sought to establish a Jewish agricultural settlement in the Soviet Union. I Corps' goal was to construct the autonomous region in the Soviet Far Eastern province of Birobidzhan. The plan succeeded, and in 1934, it became the capital of the Jewish Autonomous Republic. George himself was American by upbringing, Russian by family, and communist by indoctrination in his early years. He became involved in the communist cause, joining a local chapter of the Communist League, which in the years prior to the Cold War had not yet received pariah status. George was a delegate for the Young Communist League at the 1930 Communist Party at the Iowa Convention when he was still 16. In 1931, he was arrested for occupying a municipal office and demanding shelter for two women evicted from their homes. According to his FBI file, he commented to his schoolmates that his family planned to return to Russia in 1932. I Corps facilitated their move to Birobidzhan in the midst of the Great Depression to work on a collective farm in this so-called utopia that Russia was building for the Jews. While the region was an isolated province in the Russian Far East near the Chinese border, not exactly prime real estate, Stalin established it in the 1920s to integrate Jews into Soviet society and protect them from the anti-Semitism of Russian Gentile population, but also to create a buffer against Chinese and Japanese expansion. But for the Kovals, it was a new beginning in Russia, free from Jewish pogroms and the Tsarist past. While on the farm, Koval improved his Russian enough to study chemical engineering in Moscow at the Mendeleev Institute of Chemical Technology. He met Ludmila Ivanova while at the institute, and they married shortly afterwards. He graduated in 1939 with honors and became a Soviet citizen. We don't know when Koval began to work for the Soviet Secret Service, or the GRU, but he was drafted into the army shortly after graduation. The GRU was likely scouting universities across the Soviet Union, looking for intelligent students with potential for a career in espionage. Several years of Stalin's purges depleted the ranks of the intelligence community, and there were many open positions. Koval was perfect for the role. He was raised as an American and could pass as one with little difficulty. He had a knowledge of science, a highly valued attribute at the time when Russia wanted to develop its military capabilities against increasing Nazi aggression, and it also made it possible for him to infiltrate laboratories in America. But most of all, Koval was a doctrinaire communist. He was a true believer in the cause and would likely not defect to the West if embedded there, which was always a problem for the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War. Koval was drafted into the Soviet Army in 1939 to cover up his disappearance from Moscow. Exactly how he was recruited is unclear, but Koval has written that he did not accept an offer or military training. He never wore a uniform, nor was sworn into the armed forces. Rather, he was trained by the GRU to conduct espionage in the United States for an 8-year term, from 1940 to 1948. Koval found it easy to sneak back into America even though his parents had relinquished their U.S. passports. In October 1940, he boarded a U.S.-bound tanker. After arriving in San Francisco, he simply walked across through border control with the ship's captain, his wife, and little daughter, who sailed together with him. He immediately went to New York, and there he took command of the GRU station. Koval worked for a while and then registered for the draft. He joined the Army on February 4, 1943, and received his basic training. He then became a member of the Army Specialized Training Program, which gave talented enlisted men technical training at colleges and universities. He was enrolled in City College of New York to further develop his knowledge of electrical engineering. A fellow student at the time, Arnold Kramish, said that he was very friendly, compassionate, and smart, and never did his homework. But Kramish notes that that's because he was already a college graduate back in Moscow, even though no one knew it at the time. Koval's classmates thought it was strange that he was a decade older than them. Although he fit in well with a group of student soldiers, and he was something of a father figure, many aspects of him stood out. He smoked his cigarettes down to where they almost burned his fingers, which Kramish later learned was an Eastern European habit. He was quite a ladies' man, although his classmates didn't know that he had a wife in the Soviet Union. The Army Specialized Training Program ended shortly after Koval enrolled due to the Allied need for more combat troops. Most program participants were transferred to the infantry. Koval, however, received a spy's chance of a lifetime. The Manhattan Project suffered manpower shortages and requested technically adept recruits from the Army. A colleague of his, Duan Weiss, believed that Koval's high scores on the Army's intelligence test and his specialized training in handling radioactive materials caught their attention. Koval was sent to the blandly named Special Engineer Detachment, which was actually a branch of the nuclear project. So as you can see, back then they didn't do very thorough background checks, because if they did, they would have realized that the student who showed up in America in 1940 had been living in the Soviet Union for 8 years prior. Well, the Manhattan Project was America's most secret military endeavor. In order to produce fissile materials, it grew during the war to employ more than 130,000 and cost over $2 billion. Los Alamos devised the bomb, but Koval was sent to the Oak Ridge Laboratories, a critical research center where the bomb's parts and fuel were developed. It was considered the most difficult part of the atomic project. His job at Oak Ridge couldn't have been better for a spy mission if his Soviet officers had wished it into existence. He was an Army sergeant given the position of health physics officer, requiring him to track radiation levels throughout the complex. Koval was given top-secret clearance and access to the entire facility. He drove from building to building, making sure stray radiation didn't harm the workers. The Soviet Union now had a trained operative inside a secret center producing America's most closely guarded military technology. He was even given his own Jeep, which very few officers had. Stuart Bloom, senior physicist at the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in California, studied with Koval and called him a regular guy who played baseball and played it well, usually as a shortstop. He said, he didn't have a Russian accent. He spoke fluent English, American English. His credentials were perfect. But I saw him staring off in the distance and thinking about something else. Now I think I know what it was. Well, Koval's spy career spanned World War II and the very beginning of the Cold War, a period that ushered in the high watermark of global espionage. Koval was aware of the growing paranoia of Soviet infiltration. He took many precautions and sent information to his GRU handler through the use of couriers and diplomatic pouch from the Soviet embassy. He likely used other means that still remain unknown due to the limited number of extant sources that describe his manner of espionage, so we don't know about radio communication or anything like that. Okay, so here's the information that he stole. Manhattan Project scientists developed two types of atomic bombs, one based on a relatively simple technology that required an enriched form of uranium, the other based on plutonium, which had not been isolated until 1941. Scientists at Oak Ridge discovered that in order to build a functional plutonium warhead, they required enriched uranium and the rare element polonium to initialize a chain reaction. Both materials produced lethal levels of radiation. Strict safety protocol was required, and Koval continually monitored radiation levels throughout the complex. He also kept inventory of experimental substances that were tested for their effectiveness as bomb fuels. In his reports of Moscow, he described the Oak Ridge complex and its functions, the production of polonium and uranium, and the monthly volume of polonium. He notified them that polonium was being sent to Los Alamos. The Soviets already had a spy there, Klaus Fuchs, who gave the Soviets detailed information about the bombs. The information supplied by Fuchs and Koval and the importance of polonium allowed the Soviets to integrate the leaked scientific secrets coming from the two labs. On June 27, 1945, Koval was transferred to another secret lab in Dayton, Ohio, where the polonium initiator was being constructed and the polonium itself refined. The factories refined polonium-210, a highly radioactive material. It was crucial as polonium was considered too unstable to initiate a successful atomic reaction. Once again, Koval's status as health physics officer gave him free rein throughout the installation. He was there to witness scientific breakthroughs and the ultimate triumph of a controlled nuclear explosion. The initiator was a success, and the first atomic bomb was detonated at Trinity in New Mexico on July 16th. This was the experiment in which Los Alamos director Robert Oppenheimer, watching the terrible mushroom cloud form, quoted the Bhagavad Gita, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." 3 weeks later, in August 1945, two bombs, one uranium-based and the other polonium-based, were detonated over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, forcing Japanese Emperor Hirohito to surrender. After the detonation of the two bombs, the Soviet Union accelerated its nuclear program. The information provided by Koval and other spies pushed their program forward by years. They rapidly developed the polonium initiator for the plutonium bomb. This initiator was based on the information provided by the Soviet agent Delma, the codename for George Koval. In 1946, the CIA believed that the Soviets would not be able to successfully build an atomic bomb until 1950 at the earliest, or 1953 at the latest. Their estimates tilted toward 1953. They were shocked when intelligence reports revealed that the Soviets had tested a plutonium-based atomic bomb on August 29, 1949, at their test site in Kazakhstan. In the run-up to the Soviet nuclear triumph, Koval was offered continued classified work in Dayton, but began to fear his cover would be blown. Another GRU officer, Igor Guzenko, had defected to Canada and revealed the extent of Soviet infiltration in the United States, even within the Manhattan Project. Another scientist, Alan Nunn May, was arrested in Britain as a result of Guzenko's confession. At no point was Koval's cover in danger of falling apart. His alibi was airtight. But worries remained. Michael Sulik argues that he fled due to danger, because the Soviet Union would not have recalled him otherwise due to his excellent placement. The Soviets held on tenaciously to their spies. In the case of atomic spy David Greenglass, his handlers redirected him to the University of Chicago to target scientists working on classified military research even after he had been discharged from the United States Army and lost access. Therefore, Koval would not have left the U.S. unless capture was imminent. Andriy Shitov, a Russian chronicler of Koval, writes that a Soviet defector told the FBI that an unknown GRU chief was based in New York and dealt electronic products. American counterintelligence agents found old Soviet literature that hailed the Koval family as happy immigrants to the United States. A pamphlet read that the Kovals came to the Soviet Union and had exchanged the uncertainty of life as small storekeepers in Sioux City for a worry-free existence for themselves and their children. Intercepted Soviet intelligence cables had begun to implicate KGB-run spies such as Harry Dexter White, a senior Treasury Department official in the Roosevelt administration, who died of a heart attack before being subpoenaed in 1948. Koval's old colleagues in Oak Ridge and Dayton confirmed that they had been interviewed by the FBI in 1949 and 1950. They were asked specifically about Koval, whom they learned at this time was not an orphan, but an Iowan with communist parents. The FBI finally understood the full extent of their failure, but swore his fellow scientists to secrecy. The U.S. government refused to admit this failure, as it would have been highly embarrassing to have this divulged. But they were too late for damage control. Koval had already left America, and his departure had been planned for years. Following the end of World War II, Koval received his honorable discharge from the Army with reference to his brilliant work. He earned two medals, one for victory in World War II. Koval returned to New York, where he resumed his studies again at City College. He completed his bachelor's degree on February 1, 1948, graduating cum laude. He then told his associates that he received a job offer to plan the construction of a power plant in Europe. Koval obtained a new U.S. passport for six-month travel and used a trading company, Atlas Trading, as a cover for his travel plans. He boarded the ocean liner SS America for Le Havre in October 1948, departing American shores. Koval never returned. Koval delivered intelligence to the Soviets that advanced their military technology by years, to the point that they were nipping at the heels of the U.S. in the decades-long arms race of the Cold War. Despite his achievements, Koval was not particularly well-received in his adopted homeland. Whether due to Soviet embarrassment that they had to steal military secrets to develop their nuclear program rather than rely on their own scientific finesse, or worries that Koval could be an American double agent or mole, the intelligence establishment kept him at arm's length. He did not receive any high awards when he arrived, and his background as a spy in America negatively affected his life. When he was discharged from the Soviet Army in 1949, he was given the rank of private and described as an untrained rifleman despite 9 years of service in the armed forces. This apparent poor performance in the Army, as well as Koval's academic and foreign background, hindered his ability to find a job. He sought a position as a teacher or researcher, but suspicions about him lingered. According to his CV, he spent 10 years, from 1939 to 1949, as an enlisted soldier, but received no promotion despite his decade of service and higher education. He was only able to secure a position as a laboratory assistant at the Mendeleev Institute following Stalin's death in 1953, when his old superiors intervened with the Ministry of Higher Education. He earned his doctorate there and became a professor and prolific scientist, publishing over 100 scientific papers in the next four decades. His students thought him unexceptional, but they sometimes giggled when he pronounced the Russian words for technical terms such as thermocouple in an American accent. Koval worked as an instructor there for the next 40 years. Koval lived for decades in obscurity, unknown in America or by his compatriots. Only in 2000 did the GRU recognize his accomplishments when it threw him a closed ceremony at its headquarters. He was awarded a medal for his service to military intelligence. The story of his exploits began leaking to the Russian media, but he was still only known by his code name. He died in 2006 at the age of 92. Public appreciation only came posthumously, and even this came with an asterisk. First, Putin's acknowledgement in 2007 of Koval's contributions had less to do with honoring him and more to do with politics. The award ceremony came a month before Russian parliamentary elections and coincided with Putin's promise to restore Russia's military might. Second, nations rarely bring public attention to their spies, even long after they've died, and particularly in the paranoid secretive world of Russian espionage. It was likely to do with what Sulich describes in Spying in America as Putin touting the past achievements of the intelligence services as part of his nationalistic agenda. As a former leader of the Federal Security Service, he has significantly increased the authority, budget, and morale of Russia's intelligence services and grafted them into his personal power apparatus, blackmailing and spying on his political opponents. Few spies have done so much for their homeland but received so little recognition. But in an odd twist, Koval's understated legacy is further credit to his ability as a spy. The American-born communist never sought out a career in espionage. He only saw it as the best means to support the communist cause. He never had any regrets and truly believed in the system. This is perhaps the greatest asset for a spy to have: to be content with a job well done, even if the public never knows of his accomplishments. After all, if his job is done correctly, they never will. All right, well, that's a look at the three spies in this episode. Now, a lot has changed, obviously, since World War II. In the 21st century, you have high-resolution cameras and drones flying overhead. But despite all that, some aspects of the profession are still surprisingly low-tech. The majority of foreign spy work is done by locals, as approximately 90% of CIA employees live and work in the U.S. Those who are abroad stay close to the embassy and cling tightly to diplomatic immunity, as they wouldn't likely fit into local society anyway. Robert Evans notes that most Americans are case officers who manage foreigners who conduct the actual espionage. A local waitress or goat herder has far better knowledge on the ground than the best of foreign spies. Case in point, when SEAL Team 6 confirmed Bin Laden's death in Pakistan, they did so by matching his blood to the DNA of Bin Laden's relatives. How did they have his family's blood on hand? By the CIA running a vaccine program in Pakistan and testing every drop of blood to determine if the Bin Laden family was nearby in one town. The operation was run by a Pakistani doctor who led the program. Honey traps also continue to work well, and they don't require any modern technology to make them more efficient. In 2009, London's former deputy mayor, Ian Clement, admitted that he was seduced by a female Chinese secret agent. The two met while he was accompanying a UK Olympics delegation to Beijing to build contacts with potential investors for the 2012 Olympics in London. He met an attractive Chinese woman at an exclusive party at the opening night of the 2008 Olympics in China and decided to build a personal contact with her. After having a few drinks, they went to his hotel room, where he soon fell unconscious. Clement woke hours later, discovering his BlackBerry was missing. The woman had, quote, rifled through his confidential documents and downloaded details about how the capital is run from his BlackBerry smartphone. This happened even though MI6 briefed his delegation that the Chinese Ministry of Security often used honey traps on hapless targets to extract information. He said, "I fell for the oldest trick in the book. I didn't think for one minute that I would fall for it." That such an old trick still worked and is used much today is perhaps a real lesson of espionage in the modern age. Tactics may have changed in response to the proliferation of new technology, but the strategies are timeless. In fact, the old strategies may even be more effective than the newer ones. Sun Tzu wrote his treatise on spycraft 2,500 years ago, but he said, "If you know your enemies and know yourself, you will not be imperiled in 100 battles. If you do not know your enemies nor yourself, you will be imperiled in every single battle." And spies determine whether or not an army can know its enemy. All right, well, that is our episode on spies. If you would like me to delve deeply into a topic like this, I am always happy to hear your suggestions. You can reach out to me in one of two ways. The first is by email, and you can contact me at info@historyonthenet.com. The second way, if you really want to add a personal touch and be a celebrity on the interwebs, is to leave a voicemail. You can ask me a question, and you can find out how to do that by going to historyunplugpodcast.com. I am always happy to take your suggestions to answer whatever you can throw at me. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site, historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.